All right, on today's show, we interviewed Randy Woods, and man, has he done a bunch of different things, right? We kind of talked about what it looks like to start and bootstrap a company from scratch, what it takes to basically take a different company public while you're doing that company. And last but not least, we talked about getting acquired and how to be on the acquisition side. So, Casey, what were some of your takeaways?
Man, this guy, great guy. I love the Canadians. They always have these great stories, very personal, very worldly. But I'll tell you, part of the things that got me into the M&A space 15 years ago was I interviewed a gentleman that my dad knew, and I said, hey, how did you become, he's about 60. I said, how did you get an M&A? And he told me, he said, what you need to do is go start a company and sell it. And he was like, and then you can add value to an M&A private equity firm. Right. And so that's what I did. I set out that venture. And I was able to do that in 2019 with Energy Funders and go through what it all looks like, all the mistakes of it. I mean, and that's why we're here. And so
you made mistakes?
Oh, a ton. I still make mistakes all the time. But it kind of takes us to the summary of his story, which is fantastic. It's soup to nuts. Now you're a strategic buyer.
Yeah. And that's what Randy said. You have higher highs and you have lower lows. And it's just kind of the grind of being an entrepreneur. And then, being on the acquisition side gives you a new lens, right? You kind of know the things you look for. And I kind of really, with Randy, one of my big takeaways was actually the content side, right? It's so important. And it's something that I think used to be like near and dear to me. And I feel like we kind of moved away from it. And now I'm kind of racking my brain on, okay, like, what does it look like for me to replicate something like that at Disrupt, right? We have really strong leaders, and how do we start to leverage those people to go and do something that kind of really attract audiences, right? You've got to build up each of these different micro audiences and you get a big following. And so,
and getting in your employees, diving into your employees' intelligence, right? Mm-hmm. Because even though they may not be entrepreneurs, they all have some type of way they see it differently than we do. With your pool of people, it's a massive amount of people that you can pull a lot of great content and ideas from. So yeah, I mean, he did it with his company, and they were all over they were in Canada, some in the US, and in Brazil.
Yeah. And it was interesting to kind of, his take on just being aware of the cyclical nature of acquisitions, right? And just knowing, hey, you've seen it multiple times. There's a time to buy, there's a time to sell, right? And just being conscious that, hey, if we don't sell this cycle, we'll have to go sell in 5, 6, 7, 10 years from now, and seeing that multiple times. And so deciding, you know what, they've reached that inflection point where maybe it is a good time to sell, and, starting to work that process. So, I mean, I love talking to founders and hearing, how did it go? What went well? What didn't go well? And so we have all those nuggets in this episode.
Having the wherewithal to see the cycles, to be thinking about the cycles, because it's true. That was one of the things. He didn't speak a lot about it, but if you listen into this, just knowing that he was aware of where they were at that time to be able to make the decision to exit his company.
Well, sure. So lots of information in this episode, so we'll get right into it. Welcome to the M&A Launchpad podcast with your host, Casey and Ferris with Equity Launchpad. On this podcast, you will gain insights on acquiring, investing in, and selling profitable businesses in the lower to middle market. Whether you're a business owner, investor, or aspiring entrepreneur, at Equity Launchpad, we will provide you with the knowledge, guidance, and capital to navigate the world of mergers and acquisitions. On today's episode, we have Randy Wood. In 1905, Randy co-founded Nonlinear Creations, a marketing and technology services company. By 2017, Nonlinear expanded globally, operating in Canada, the US, Brazil, and the UK. Randy orchestrated the strategic sale of Nonlinear to Valtech, a global agency focused on acquiring other companies. He elected to join the acquirer and today plays a key role in their acquisition strategy. Currently, Randy drives revenue growth for Valtech in North America, actively exploring potential acquisitions. His unique perspective, having been both a founder and being part of the selling firm and a corporate representative of buying one, fuels his passion for guiding entrepreneurs through exit processes. Randy, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
No problem. Glad to have you on. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, actually. Yeah, it's been a great start to the year.
Awesome. Well, let's go ahead and get this kicked off. And so, maybe for those listeners, you want to kind of just give a little bit of a background of you and kind of how you got into your first business.
Oh, interesting. It's always challenging to go back and remember what life was like before you started your business. So you go back to 1995, which is a long time ago in internet years. It's certainly a long time ago in just real years. I had a university buddy, and we both had pretty good jobs for mid-20s individuals, but we felt like we wanted to take a swing at doing something on our own, right? Something a bit different. So he decided to quit his job as a seller of software to the former Soviet Union, and I quit my job as a lobbyist for the federal government in Canada, though I was for the good guys. I worked for the environmental lobby and the Heart and Stroke Foundation, so I was on the side of the angels.
He was on the bad guys, right?
He's on the bad guys, so the guy we balanced, right? It was a good partnership. But literally, we just decided one day at the gym that we should just try and do something on our own. And that internet thing sounded kind of interesting back in 95. Al Gore's information superhighway, for those that are old enough to recall. Nobody really knew what the internet was broadly then. We just knew that it was growing quickly and we were able to get our brains around it. We did not come from technology backgrounds, but we knew enough technology to be dangerous. None of us were developers, but we found we were able to hire those fairly quickly. And really, it was one of those things you can do when you don't have a mortgage and don't have kids that you probably can't do once you have a mortgage and kids. We just quit, rented a very small, half falling down, dilapidated shack as our office, and then hired a couple other 20-somethings to help us out, and we grew from there.
How'd you have the money to hire those 20-somethings at the beginning?
Oh, that was interesting. There was a job creation program by the federal government that would subsidize them dramatically, but they had to be from non-traditional backgrounds. So we hired, I think it was a plumber and a plastics manufacturer were our first employees. We turned them into HTML developers back in 1995. So we were creative. Let's just put it that way.
So it sounds like back in the 90s, the government was trying to incentivize people to get into tech, right? And now we almost have the opposite. You have programs that are trying to get the blue collar kind of, you know, job path and career growth opportunities.
Yeah. And I should also say, because we were a services business, you know, one of the advantages of starting a services business as opposed to a product business is you generally get cash up front or very close to when the work is done. So it's a little bit self-funding and it's certainly easier to bootstrap than if you have to invest, I don't know, $1 million to build a restaurant or something before you see your first dollar.
Yeah. And so then I guess, what exactly was the vision when you started it, right? What did you guys set out to do at the time? I mean, you wanted to get into the internet, but hey, yeah, did you know you're going to be an agency or what did you guys envision initially?
No, like big money, no whammies, something like that. honestly, the internet at that point, it's really hard to recall, but it was like, it was so nascent that no one really knew what it was or where it was going. Like this is just as Netscape had launched the first browser, right? It was the first time it was ever starting to be seen by people who didn't go and get a comp sci degree. So we knew there was opportunity. We didn't really have much more vision than can we find people to pay us to tell them about the internet or to do something. We managed to land early on a contract with the National Gallery of Canada, which is fairly prestigious in Canada and recognized in both private and public sector. So it was a really great opportunity for us. And when that launched in February 96, it was front page news in Canada across all the major papers, which is ridiculous when you think about it. Like a website launching was front page news in like our major national newspapers. But it was a perfect win for us because suddenly we were the experts, right? We were about 6 minutes ahead of everybody else, but we were the experts. And that was okay at that point in time. And so we found ourselves running around and building a bunch of HTML websites at that point, using Notepad or whatever our tools were available because there weren't very many. And then that company evolved. We evolved with the internet. We eventually became an integrator of package solutions, became a partner of Sitecore. We did some advertising work that came and went. For a while, we were doing live streaming video with Warner Brothers for a bit. You know, that was a piece of the puzzle too. So we played with whatever people were willing to invest in as the internet matured. We tended to put a foot in that water. Does that make any sense?
Would I describe that? And I was gonna say, it absolutely does. I mean, you're preaching my language because you know, that 99 to 2005 era, that's whenever I was, you know, I'm about 10 years younger probably. So I was probably too young to do anything professional, right? But I made a lot of money as a high schooler playing that world and, you know, seeing it evolve. And, you know, and I remember just flipping domains was like my first business, right? Like, and there's so many domains that in hindsight, I'm like, man, I should have picked up those domains, right? And held them, right? I didn't have that business mindset, but it was a little bit of the Wild West back then. And it's just been amazing to see what the internet has turned into, right?
Well, the funny thing is that all the promise of the dot-com boom, and it was ridiculous and irrational exuberance and all of that, but everything people thought was going to happen happened. It just didn't happen in 6 months, right? It took more like 6 to 8 years for it to happen, but none of it was wrong. And for what it's worth, I kind of feel like we're at that moment with AI right now where there's a whole lot of promise. It's going to change every part of the economy. I don't think it's going to happen by next January, though, so we may get ahead of ourselves in valuations. But I do think it is like the internet, a place where it's going to change everything. So that, you know, your grandmother will be using AI the way that your grandmother uses Facebook, right? There's going to be something happening that's really real. So I kind of feel like that's happening now for what it's worth.
Pretty amazing. So how long was the journey of your bootstrap to then your next phase in that? How many years did you guys spend in that?
Well, we spent 23 years. So we bootstrapped the whole way. We never raised external capital for the services company. We did have a side adventure where we spun off some software and, as I suggested earlier, raised some money, blew up gloriously in the dot-com crash. And that's a whole other set of learnings that we had. But yeah, the services company, we grew out of revenue for 23 years. And as life went on, we expanded. We found ourselves with a model where we sold to American customers primarily, and also the UK. So we had operations in the US and the UK. And then we paid our people in Canadian dollars and Brazilian reais. And that model turns out to be pretty profitable. We went to Brazil quasi-intentionally, found ourselves with a group there, eventually incorporated. And that's a hard thing to do in Brazil. But we found our way through their network and rather confusing legal structures. And once we got established there, we found ourselves with access to just brilliant talent at a cost that we could actually afford. And that model worked for us, right? There's a bit of currency arbitrage and there's a bit of nearshoring. And together between British pounds and US dollars, we did okay.
So in that journey of, I guess, 23 years, right? I mean, you didn't have any previous leadership skills. You didn't have any like management EOS that they offer today. So what were you guys doing? I mean, was it just learn as you go? And did at one point
stumble forward, my friend,
just absolutely created? I mean,
in retrospect, you know, but if you looking backwards, it's really easy to know what we should have done, but that's always the case. If it's not the case, then you're a very fortunate person or you didn't try very hard. I kind of feel like we used to joke about our business strategy being just make every mistake possible, but make it once. Right? Like, just don't do it twice. So we did. We made a huge number of mistakes. Like, we probably didn't have to invent bookkeeping from first principles, right? We might have wanted to hire an accountant rather than doing it all in Excel. Or, you know, we might have thought about how we structured our leadership team earlier, our management rhythms, all the stuff that we learned along the way. Yeah, now you can pick up a book like EOS or any of the other systems. There's a number of them out there and give you some guidance on how you might do that. We found it by trial and error. And do you say stumble forward? Because that's a really good way of phrasing it, right? Like we kept working until it didn't work. And then we changed what wasn't working and hoped that would work. And we got to a point where with the right people, you can get away with that, right? Yeah. It doesn't work if you haven't got the right people. With the right people, you can do amazing things.
No, it's everybody thinks, you know, they see a company and think it has its act together. And usually you don't. It's about stumbling forward and just making sure you don't fall, right? You just keep moving forward and just keep landing the next step as best as you can and just not fall. And so, yeah, no day is like the other. But let me ask you this. I mean, was there, you know, was your growth linear or was there just a pivotal thing that happened that just really kind of, you know, basically changed the trajectory of the company?
Yeah, it was not linear. Company's name is nonlinear, but that's nothing to do with their growth rate. Listen, from 95 to 2000, you could do no wrong, right? The tide was coming in, all boats were going up. Crazily forgiving place to start a business because you can make all kinds of mistakes and still get away with it. There was far more demand than there was supply. Really fun place to be a young entrepreneur. After the dot-com crash, we didn't have a lot of dot-coms in our portfolio, but there was a real pullback on investment across the board. And you know that definitely hit us. So if you think about it, we grew like this, we shrank. I got to learn all those fun things about how you do layoffs in various parts of the country. Didn't realize there were so many different laws in each state in the union or each province in Canada. So got to learn all about doing layoffs, not the funnest part of the journey. So we reinvented ourselves at that point, found a different value proposition, changed how we went to market, invested in some salespeople that were very highly paid and very successful. And we grew fairly consistently. And then somewhere around 2008, not really related to the financial crisis, but we lost a couple of salespeople when we realized that we could no longer, how to put this, when you've got a really good salesperson, when they leave you, they leave with their book of business. It's really tough to continue your growth path. And so we very deliberately shifted from a sales-led organization to a marketing-led organization. We invested in creating content. We'd shut down the whole company for half a day every month and everyone wrote. I didn't care if you were the janitor or the HR manager or our chief architect, right? Everyone wrote and we published. And within a couple of years, we were dominating our niche online for most of the key search terms. And that turned into a steady flow of leads, which turned into really consistent revenue growth to the point where we could predict 6 months out how many new deals we'd get. And that shift probably was the accelerant that let us grow to the point where exiting to Valtech made sense.
No, it's and that was probably what, the early 2010s?
Yeah, so we started it in 2008-09, and then somewhere around 2010, it really took off. Yeah,
that's probably I remember seeing that shift. No, kudos to you. I mean, so it sounds like, you know, instead of letting salespeople going fishing their own leads, you were bringing them leads on a platter that they needed to close, but obviously that put the power back in your hands, right? You're not kind of susceptible to people that are essentially going to use their book as their leverage, right, to take advantage of the company. And
we actually got to the point we had very few salespeople. Like we would just have our executive team or our best technology person pitch what they were going to do. And the credibility that came with that was super high. So as long as you had a lead flow high enough and then you selected your opportunities, you could really do that and kind of avoid the whole salesy process entirely. And I'm sorry, I interrupted you.
No, and what was the average deal size?
Oh, at that point, we were probably 350,000, 400,000, somewhere in that area.
Well, pretty big. So yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah. There was an incredible book and I wish I knew the name of it, but it talks a lot about getting your employees to engage in writing content, right? So even before that book was written, you employed that, you got that out there. So how do you get the buy-in on something? How do you get the employees?
It's amazing what desperation will do for you, but a couple of things. I joke, but we had a really good team. So our team felt very coherent. We did a lot of internal communications. We had basically open book management. There's profit sharing. We spent a lot of time educating our team on how to read a balance sheet, for example, so they can understand the numbers when we shared them. So they all understood the status of the company at almost every time. So it was part of it, right? They felt kind of part of the team and involved and engaged in the mission, part one. Second thing is that we really celebrated the wins around content publication. So we would, at every monthly all hands, we would announce which of the various pieces that have been published had the most views, which had the biggest distribution. There were prizes for people who had the biggest increase from one year to the next. You can see, like, the whole point was it became clear to everyone in the organization that the way you move ahead in the company or the way that you gain prominence is by publishing really solid material. And so it became kind of self-motivating. And the truth was the best people in the company produced the best material. And so everyone aspired to be them. And there was a kind of upward spiral of goodness that worked out. So that wasn't deliberate, but that's how it actually ended up working out.
I love that. Yeah. Well, offline, there's another company I'll tell you about a little later. I remember they just did that. And I think they got phenomenal growth. And now you're kind of inspiring me. I think my leadership's not going to like me going back and just saying, all right, guys, starting today, everyone needs to write content. But I'm a huge proponent of content. And it's funny, it's the way we've built the company to where we are now was really content and education. And then we've kind of almost, you know, fallen back a little bit, right? You get so busy running the thing and you kind of, you know, you fall backwards a little bit. Now I'm just getting rejuvenated of, hey, we should probably revisit that and just kind of get a more thorough strategy and getting everybody bought in.
It's amazing probably to dip into your employees' minds because a lot of them have their own creative genius, right? And they're the ones that blow you away the most because you're like, wow, it's things I didn't see.
Total side effect of this, utterly unplanned, is that we very quickly figured out who the super smart people that we didn't know were, right? Like junior team members that had just joined us or that were in Brazil that we didn't see. When you read what they wrote, you realize, like, okay, this person is like, that's a keeper. That's a star we have to hang on to. And it's really hard to get that visibility as you grow, right? It's not hard when you're 30 people, but if you have to 110 or 120 people across different geographies, that line of sight to who your stars are is really difficult. And that was not intended, but it was hugely valuable that came out of that process.
Yeah.
And last question on this before we get to your part is, you know, so when you have so many different locations and you mentioned you have a monthly on deck, like you have everybody coming together. How did you pull that off before the days of Zoom? That we didn't all have teams and we didn't have all that stuff. So what did you do in order to have an all hands for all those different locations?
What did we do? That's a good question. So we didn't use Teams. WebEx maybe. Yeah. But there was something before WebEx that we used as well. And I'm sorry, I'd have to go back in the archive to see. So it was clunky. There was no streaming video, but we were able to share the PowerPoints and the audio, right? So that's really what we did for the most part. The PowerPoint, whatever slide where you're using, became really important. And we had the same rhythm each month, so people knew what to expect. And generally speaking, we'd do like an all hands for the entire organization, and then each region would have 15 minutes either before or after where they would do their own thing. Early on, we experimented with actually having live cameras in the office so that when you sat down at the lunch table, you'd basically be looking into the lunch table in Brazil or something. We couldn't get the technology to work, but I still think it would have been a great idea. It was just too early for it to actually work out.
Yeah. No, there's one right now. It's the robot that you can control. So people that are remote can basically be in the office by having like a little robot with an iPad and it's showing their face and they can just navigate around the office. And so there was one company that opened it up to the public and someone figured out a way to sneak the device out of the building. They were trying to lock it in within the building and they were able to, you know, just, yeah. So.
Oh, the stuff that's coming, like it's going to be insane.
Yeah.
It's going to be insane. So talk to us a little bit about, so 23 years, right? And then comes a time where you're now ready to exit. Were you now going out and seeking that, or did somebody come out and find you?
Yes, and both. Here's how this worked. Shannon and I have been running the company long enough to realize that the window opens to sell your company and then it closes, right? So there are times when valuations are high, money's cheap, there's lots of demand, and that will be followed by a period where that's not true. And so 2016, things are going really well for us. We've had a great growth curve. We're an implementer of something called Sitecore, which is a really hot technology. There weren't very many firms able to do it. So all the things were lining up for us. And we sat together, you know, and had a beer, as we frequently did. Probably that's the problem with being university buddies, is that that beer drinking thing continues all the way through the whole. We said, like, we either have to exit now or we have to wait for the next cycle. Right. We knew it was going to be now or there'd be like a dearth. And right now we're in the middle of a quiet period. So we knew, and COVID would have been tough. Right. So we knew it was like now or wait 5-8 years. And we thought where we were in our life, where the company was, where our team was, because they were, we had great team members been with us for like 20 years, 18 years, 17 years. And they were often better, had more potential than we could help them fulfill inside our company, right? We couldn't grow the company fast enough for them to have the career path they deserved. And that was one of our motivations to join a bigger firm, was to let them to rise to their level of their ability. So that was the conversation. And so we said, yes, let's formally go to market. Now, one of our indicators was that people were calling us and saying, would you like to be bought? So that's the other half. We knew there was demand because people were asking. So we went and got a banker. I ran the process. Shannon ran the company with Dan and Ali, our executive team. That worked out really well. I was able to, we weren't distracted by the process because I was able to take it on my own and run it with our banker. And we talked to, I don't know, 80, 100 different potential acquirers or investors over the year. We kind of ran down both processes. Like, do we want to raise money or do we want to exit fully? And very late in the process, Valtech came to the table. We hadn't known them, but our banker brought them to the table. And very clearly, very quickly, we realized they were the right firm for us.
Got it. So, you know, it sounds like you used a traditional investment banker and you had a good experience with it, right? You're happy you did it. You don't kind of, hey, we should have done it any differently.
Yeah, I think it's, I give this advice to other entrepreneurs when asked, and people spend a lot of time thinking about who they want to sell their company to. You just spend about that same amount of time thinking about who you want to help you to sell your firm. So your selection of who the banker is, your broker, it's a critical decision, and it's not one you should make lightly. It's one that I think you should think like really hard about, because they have the potential to make or break the biggest transaction you're going to do in your life. So don't underestimate the time you should take just to really vet them, understand not just kind of their track record, but who you'll be dealing with, how senior they are, how closely their values align with yours. It's similar, I think, in many ways to hiring a senior employee. Like, you have to make all those same kinds of decisions, and some of them are at the gut level. So that's my recommendation around that. Yes, we did okay. Knowing what I know now, we might've made different choices, but you know, we ended up in the right place. So I can't complain too much.
And what was the time frame? So when you engaged with the investment banker, and then when you actually went with Valsource, what would that time frame look like?
I think we were probably 8 months from the time. Oh, it might be longer than that. Maybe closer to a year from when we first engaged them, because then we had to get all our due diligence and stuff pulled together. I think our sort of active roadshow was maybe 6 to 8 months. And then once we once Valtech became apparent that deal was likely to happen, between sort of the handshake through the letter of intent to closing was about 6 weeks. So it was very fast. After we found the right partner, things moved very quickly.
Were they the only LOI that you guys had, or was it the only one they all accepted? I mean, did y'all get down the aisle with anybody else?
Down the aisle a couple of times, but it became clear pretty quickly that we weren't good fits, either culturally. In one case, Shannon turned to me in one of the meetings and said, I think he's trying to fire me and they haven't bought the company yet. Can they do that? Is that a thing we can do? So that wasn't going to work. And in other cases, Brazil was really a strength for us, we thought, but there were lots of firms that were scared of the complexities of Brazilian law. So if you're a 1,000-person professional services firm in Ohio that only does work in Ohio, you know, Canadian law scares you, let alone Brazilian law. So a couple of those just died on the table because they couldn't get their head around how to operate multinationally. But actually, it all worked out for the best, because Valtech was a great fit culturally. They were already multinational, so that wasn't an issue. In fact, the fellow that led their M&A team at that point ended up having a cottage very close to our office in Florianopolis, Brazil, which was like the craziest thing ever, because it made clearly evident to us that he understood the dynamics of, you know, living in LATAM. So they're just a great fit, and they've proven to be a great fit after the sale as well.
Awesome.
And now, what's your role? What's your role with Valtech?
My role's evolved with Valtech. So Valtech has a philosophy of keeping founders around if they can, post-acquisition. And to do that, they usually take you out of your role of running your team and putting you into a different role. And initially, I was involved, bounced around a few different things. They needed fixed. So I was kind of a fixer in the organization. In the last couple of years, they've asked me to take a lead role in the M&A process in North America, basically helping them identify new firms that would be appropriate to add, that solves our problems and that have the kind of cultural similarities that would allow us to acquire them. So think about me sourcing deals for Valtech, framing them up, and then sometimes doing the integration work afterwards.
Got it. Well, speaking of deals, so let's go back to your deal though, right? So ultimately, you know, how did they value the company? What did y'all do on the structure side, right? You know, what did it take to get the deal done? And were there certain things that you and your partner knew you were looking for, or things that you knew that you weren't going to agree to right up front, that you basically told your investment banker, like, hey, I'm not going to do a blank. A lot of times it's a seller carry, right? It's one of those things. I mean, what did that all look like?
Like any services firm, you know, what we wanted was cash on the barrel head. We realized that's unlikely to happen all the time. We were looking for a home for our team, right? We wanted.
And how big of a team was it?
The team was about 110 people at that point, I think. Okay. It depends a little bit on how you count the contractors in some Latin American countries, but like about that size. And we just wanted confidence in our gut that they were going to be able to like succeed in this new organization. Those are the two biggest, I guess, pieces of the puzzle. We had a number in mind, but we were going to let the market determine what it was worth and then decide whether it was worth that to us or not. And the Valtech deal was, you know, checked all those boxes. Valtech was about 2,000 people at that point. It's about 6,000 now, to give you a sense of the growth. But of those 2,000, very few were in North America, maybe 100. So by bringing our team in, essentially, our senior execs were suddenly senior execs inside Valtech because there wasn't a North American structure. So it was a perfect fit for our smart key people like Daniel Roberish or Allison Abraham, who very quickly became very senior people in a global organization, right? So that was a big checkbox for us. And then Valtech, the valuation was reasonable. Services companies always trade within a range, right? So you're not going to get like the software as a service kind of valuation. So it was within that range.
What's the multiple for a services company? And this is purely professional services, right? To be more specific, right? Range, just so people listening can add.
I don't know. You see like four to eight times EBITDA, but it changes by time. Right now, I think the numbers have come down. We were in a pretty good place at our point in time. Sometimes they'll trade on revenue multiples if it's fast growth, right? Somewhere between like 0.9 revenue to 1.1. That's just like top of my mind. I haven't got any formal numbers right now.
4 to 8. So it's not too bad. I thought it was going to be higher than that. So that's just reasonable.
Yeah.
See, some of these multiples, you're just like, man, how did they make some of this stuff work? Right.
No. If you're a software as a services company, right, you might get the enormous multiples on top of that. Professional services, they're basically buying the cash flow going forward, right? In most cases, if you're in a tech company, maybe it's a bit more than that. And if they want your management team, like they did in our case, if they want your region, it varies, but let's put it this way. If Shane and I could go back in time and we're a bit smarter, we probably should have started like Google or Facebook or something, but we didn't. So this is the valuation we get.
Life's a lot easier in hindsight. I still remember thinking about starting YouTube, but once upon a time, something like a YouTube, but thinking like it's too expensive to do video hosting, right? I was too young and naive to know about it. It's okay if you lose money for 15 years. You just got to go raise the equity and it's all about the long game.
So when we started out talking, right, at the very beginning, so you've been a bootstrap entrepreneur, right? You didn't take any capital on this company in. Nope. You guys raised it, made it happen, and grown it. Now, there was a point inside of that, though. You mentioned you did a tech venture, and you also went to the Canadian market. Was it the stock exchange?
Yeah, so let me explain that, because it's a complicated story. I'll try to do it quickly. We could probably spend 3 hours, and this is another place where beer helps actually tell the story, because it was a painful one. So 98, roughly, maybe 99, we'd realized that we were having a hard time explaining to our clients whether they were being successful or not online. This is the years before Google Analytics, right? It didn't exist. Web Trends existed. That's the one thing. It's crazily expensive, super difficult to deploy and manage. So we built a technology so that our clients were able to understand if we were actually delivering value to them. And then we realized that technology was much more valuable as a technology than as a service offering for us. So we raised some angel money from some local, fairly high net worth individuals. We spent out a company called Bystream, B-U-Y Stream. And basically it was Google Analytics, right? Used a very similar technology. If you look back at the interface, it looked kind of comparable to what Google Analytics used to be. And we raised an angel round. We got a bunch of clients. We raised a venture capital round from led by Safeguard Scientific out of Philadelphia. Yep. So I think it was 23 million US was the announced number. So it was one of the bigger venture rounds for software in Canadian history at that point in time, especially because the Canadian dollar was weak. So that turned into a lot of Canadian dollars. The trick being that we didn't get all the cash up front. We got it in tranches, and we were like the last company to raise money before the dot-com crash happened. We're like that guy hanging off the helicopter, right? Getting dragged out. So all that to say, the second tranche didn't show up, and there's some complexity there. So we had to very quickly wind down that company. Not wind it down. We were able to reduce our size quickly. We ran it for a couple more years. We were able to restructure the company. So the venture capital firm was no longer involved. It was just the original founders and the angels. And at that point, we sold the intellectual property to a company called Watchfire, which eventually was bought by IBM. So that was one way that our angel investors got repaid. And then we took the empty company. And at that point in time, there was a way of using the losses in the company to structure an oil and gas exploration company. It's a really complicated tax thing. Huh? Wow. And I won't claim that I really understand it. Basically, what it allows us to do is, for certain types of exploration companies, the losses in the company flow through to the investor's personal tax accounts, right? So if you invest, you get a write-down on your taxes. So the losses in the company had value in that circumstance. And so we turned it into a firm called Fair West Energy, which then traded on the Toronto Stock Exchange. So that's the long story. The short way of saying it is that I'm not sure we were successful, but most of our angels got their cash back or very close, which made us more successful than most of the dot-coms. So I figure that's a win in my book.
I would call it a huge win. And man, and all of this while you were still running the other company.
Well, there's two of us, remember, right? So we kind of bounced back and forth. And we also had some very good senior team. Daniel Roberge basically ran it, and we checked in for breakfast on Fridays, right? So I can't claim that we were really doing both jobs well.
Sometimes. So then I guess for Valtech, going back to Valtech, for the deal itself, right? Did you get that kind of cash up front like you wanted, or was it an earn out? I mean, how they ended up structuring it?
No or no. So we had a fixed price, but the structure was shares and cash, right? So some cash up front, especially because of the way the taxation in Canada works. If you sell to a foreign company, you pay taxes on the whole thing up front, whether you get the money or not. So you have to make sure you get enough cash to cover that. So it's, the whole structure had to be negotiated. But yeah, we were very happy with it. It was a very substantial part of the total was in cash, and the rest was in shares. And then, those shares, we were able to navigate through that and get value for them as well. So as the company grew, our net worth increased as well. So yeah, a good story all around.
Awesome. And so today you're just out there talking to guys like us, listeners like this, and trying to find nice businesses to buy, right? I mean, what type of businesses are you guys focusing on?
Traditionally, Valtech has acquired founder-led companies, very much like ours, right? In the, let's say, 10 million revenue to 30 million revenue range. So that's been where we've had a great deal of success in rolling them in. There's a real respect for the entrepreneurial fire that you get in those kind of organizations. And that's historically what we've acquired. So we acquired a performance marketing firm in Charlotte a couple of years ago, which was a bit of a stretch for us because it was an area we wanted to be in, but we hadn't been in. So by bringing in a firm in Charlotte, they just fit. Like the people there really understood how to make things happen. There wasn't a lot of overhead or sort of complexity. And so it was fairly easy. So that's what we looked for historically. Right now,
in the digital marketing space?
No, that was an exception, actually. So right now, the deals that we're looking at more commonly are integrators. So somebody who might be in the data engineering space, I'd love to talk to them. Or if you're like an Adobe partner who can implement the Adobe stack, we're certainly looking for that. But all that with a big caveat, because the big news for this year is that in February, Kin and Carta's board recommended us to their shareholders to acquire them. And we're waiting for antitrust to complete. So essentially, Kin and Carta is about a 2,000 person organization. And our board was the one that actually pulled that together. I wasn't part of the deal, but that's a huge deal for Valtech, right? Like we're used to buying companies that are much smaller than that and more in the 100 to 300 person range, whereas this is a big company. And that will probably mean that we're spending some time figuring out how to integrate this much larger beast than we have previously.
Integration is a hard part. And so everything in the software space though, right? You guys aren't going to go buy a plumbing company, would y'all?
No, it's all tech integration generally. We do have some, you know, we have some brand, we have some really cool, we've got a theme park division, which does amazing things, right? But again, all in the technology space. So we do the software behind things, Mario Brothers World in Japan, right? So like some of the cool stuff that happens there, some of our guys did the magic for that, some of our gals did. So we've got like a fairly broad breadth. We actually have a joint venture with Audi that is helping build the next glass for the inside of the car, right? The actual operating system for your vehicle. So we do a lot of things that are all tech related, but they often have a creative or a brand element on top of it. And so that's what we bring to the table.
So when you find that co-founder, right? What are those, like, what are your initial, like if co-founders listening right now that fit right into what you guys like to do, what are those things in your due diligence? What are you looking for?
Sure. I'm going to take like the big deals off the table and talk about the ones that are sort of still founder led, because that's where I actually have more influence. So there's a few things, right? It has to fit the technology, like it has to be what we need. If you're in a space that's just sort of just additive for us, it's probably not going to happen for you because we're not going to pay very much. But say we need, in Europe, we're really strong in a given technology, but we have no capability of executing that in North America. We might look for a firm that can fill that gap. Right. So part of it is like, do you check that box? And then there's the financials, right? At the end of the day, we're a financially rigorous organization. So if you're a services company that's losing money, we're probably not going to talk to you. Right. But if you're growing quickly or even moderately and you have solid profitability, then you know that's a conversation we'll have. Those are kind of getting in prices. And then you get into the intangibles, right? That first meeting with the founders tells you a lot about the culture of the organization, how they present themselves, what motivates them, which often trickles to the organization. And there are times in that very first meeting, you know, it's like, nope, that's not going to work. This is not a firm that we want to be part of the team. And there's other times where you meet and it feels like you're talking to somebody you've worked with for 20 years. And it's pretty clear there's an organizational structure we can put together that'll benefit both sides.
So what is the biggest mistake, you know, founders are making, right? Whether it's that first meeting, financials, is it, you know, their back office? What are the biggest things that you think that you constantly see that you're like, man, if you guys just get ahead of this, you'd be in a much better position?
There's a lot of ways to do things incorrectly when it comes to acquisitions. You can have a very successful company that's very hard to buy. And that's the thing that I spend my time often conveying to firms. So most firms that are going to market that have hired a banker or a broker have had this conversation, right? But if you're getting ready, you have to think through things like, what do my financials look like, right? How much, how aggressive have I been in sort of minimizing my personal taxes within the company? Because that often turns into like numbers that just don't make sense from the outside and you can't get the value for it. I understand why you do it, but it's just not a great place to be when it comes time to actually sell the firm. So clean up your books, make sure they're running like solidly. Audited books are ideal. If you're really small, maybe not, but make sure that you're doing the things you need to do so that an external accounting firm can look at it and give our board, for example, comfort that the numbers make sense, right? We had one deal die because they couldn't, because they could never get their head around the way the accounting was done. So just invest the time, energy, and take the hit, professionalize your accounting. That's one thing I would suggest. I'd also suggest if you're seriously thinking about going to market that you take a hard look at your contracts, both employee and client contracts, and just make sure that they'll stand up to scrutiny by, you know, one of the big legal firms, because it's another area where we see there's often shortcuts taken, but they cost you in the long run, right? So it's worth getting your legal the paperwork figured out. It's not the most exciting part of being an entrepreneur, but if you get that done, it makes the deal an awful lot easier to get done. So there's two things. And then the non-business stuff, and this is actually in many ways more important, like get aligned with your spouse, partner, family, key stakeholders. Make sure they agree they want to do this. Make sure they're prepared for it. Make sure they're on board. Make sure everyone's aligned. Because I can tell you from experience, both personal, but also from acquiring companies, that deals often die for no reason, for nothing to do with the company, but much to do about the shareholder structure or the interpersonal challenges of the founders, right? So getting that figured out ahead of time makes it a lot more likely you'll get the deal done.
A bunch of solid advice. It's funny. That's what Equity Launchpad, we've kind of structured the company to where we have basically what we call the backbone, right? The thing that most entrepreneurs don't focus on until it's almost like too late, right? Sales, marketing, HR, IT, accounting, legal, right? Those are not the sexy part of the business. Most people are excited to build a product or go sell a product or, you know, get people through the door and go close stuff. But like you said, accounting is a very, very important part of a company. Same thing with legal, same thing, even with HR and processes, methodologies, contracts, all of those things are critical. And so we kind of saw that same problem. And that's really the value that we add to any of our portfolio companies, right? As we acquire them, and that's, we can bring those systems, processes, price, and kind of bring them up to that level of maturity.
Yeah. I talked to some people, not really coaching, but I'll be asked for my thoughts by some fellow entrepreneurs. And I'll say, like, you got to start thinking about your firm from the outside in as an investor, right? Like, pretend you don't know how your firm works. How would you give me comfort that it actually works? And that kind of often will, you know, check the box or turn the light bulb on. It's like, oh yeah, right. I can see where you'd have no idea how this works. Cause often we just make things up on the fly, which is great. And it works for you, but you can't sell that. Right?
It's crazy how that accounting, all of that stuff that you don't want to do comes back to haunt you.
Process documentation, all that stuff, right? Yeah.
Yeah, it is crazy. Well, I'll tell you what, Randy, it's been fantastic meeting with you here today. I mean, not many times you get to meet a bootstrapped entrepreneur that's also taken venture capital money in another business, went the public route, and now in his life is a strategic buyer. So you've hit all spectrums of entrepreneurship, my friend.
Yeah, I want to grow up and be Randy.
No, right? That's it.
I would not wish that on my worst enemy. So no, you don't want that. But it has been an interesting career. I will say that so far. I've very much enjoyed it. And while I certainly, as I suggested, we've made lots of mistakes, none of them were fatal. So, you know, that's a big piece of it.
Yeah. Last little piece of words of encouragement for the people that are listening.
Yeah. Listen, I think being an entrepreneur is a really difficult lifestyle, but if you're the right person, it's probably the most rewarding experience you can imagine. The highs are higher, the lows are lower. Failure is more likely than not, but if you've got the stomach lining to manage it, there are very few things that are more rewarding than kind of wading into the unknown and making your own path there.
Beautiful. Well, thank you for that. And so let's jump into our rocket round.
Oh, the rocket round. Okay.
I hope you're ready for that.
You're excited. Yeah.
So kicking off the first one. So what do you like to do in your free time?
I've got a few hobbies. I still scuba dive a lot. My brother lives in Kenya right now. He's lived in a whole bunch of places around the world with various aid organizations. And when I'm able to, I will go and visit him someplace and we'll get a bit of time underwater. So that's been a passion over the years. I boxed for years and I'm still active in the community. So I'm obviously not competitive anymore, but I very much enjoy working out with some of the younger folks and some of the charity fighters. There's a lot of charity fights happening now, and it's useful to have somebody my age to get beaten up by the prospective boxers. That takes a lot of time.
We won't bring up Mike Tyson's upcoming fight, so we won't bring that up.
Leave that aside. He's in better shape than I am, though. I'll tell you that.
Yeah, speaking of scuba diving, I like to say that was, it's a class, I took that class in college, and I like to say that was one of the most useful classes I took in college and one of the few that I still apply each year, right? So
it's great.
All right. Well, next question. So what's been, you know, your most memorable moment in your journey, right? There's been lots of highs, you know, what's been the highest of the highs?
Yeah. 23 years, right? Before we sold the firm, and then like 7 years since then. So you need me to pick one. People would probably think I'm going to say the day we signed the deal, right, and sold the company. But actually, that's weirdly anticlimactic because you've had like 8 months of working towards that. You basically want to go to bed at that point. You're so tired from the due diligence. Like, it's not as celebratory as you might think. Probably the most memorable was when we actually closed that very first deal with the National Gallery of Canada, right? It wasn't actually our first client, but it was our first substantive client. And for us to win that, two guys, early 20s, mid-20s, no real context or background against, I think IBM was one of the bidders for this, right? Like, we were so far out of our depth that to pull that deal off, we knew it was going to change the complexion of everything. And I think that was probably one of our better celebrations.
Yeah. It's validating what you're doing. And, you know, luckily you're a scuba diver, so it's good to be, outside far of the depths. So.
All right. And last one. So what is your favorite tool or resource that you like to use?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. Honestly, I was thinking probably LinkedIn, like Sales Navigator, is where I spend most of my time in terms of like pruning through who it is I might be able to talk to. If I'm thinking about like technical tools, right? That's probably the one that I use most frequently to introduce myself to new people. I think if you do it diligently, it can be very, very helpful.
Awesome.
Oh, fantastic.
Randy. Thank you very much. Definitely a wealth of knowledge. And so I guess for those listening, I guess, how can people get a hold of you?
Sure. Probably the easiest is to find me on LinkedIn. If you just type in Randy Woods and Beltec or Nonlinear, I expect I'll pop up.
All right. Nice, easy name, you know, like Ferris Musa. I always have to spell it out for people because they're not going to just type that out into a thing.
Exactly.
Awesome. Well, Randy, hey, thank you very much. Really appreciate it. I think it was a wealth of information for the listeners.
Yeah. Learned a lot.
Great. Not at all. Been great fun. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the M&A Launchpad podcast. If you've enjoyed today's podcast and would like to support us, please leave us a rating and a review after you listen. If you're looking for guidance on your next business acquisition or sale, capital to support your next business transaction, or to invest in a private equity opportunity, visit equitylaunchpad.com to learn more and to connect with our team. If you know of an individual who would be a great guest for the show, head over to equitylaunchpad.com/nominate, where you'll have the chance to refer yourself or someone else to be a guest on our show. I'm Casey Minshew, and I look forward to talking with you next week.